You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we look at new research from UW-Madison that may lead to changes in bald eagle protection.
First, the 14th annual State of the Tribes Address took place this afternoon at the Wisconsin State Capitol. The annual event brings together the 11 federally recognized tribes of Wisconsin, and this year's speech was given by Menominee Chairman Gary Bisaw.
Topics ranged from environmental protections to the opioid crisis and how the state government can work with tribal governments on these issues and more. Here's a bit of what Chairman Bisaw had to say to state lawmakers.
As nations, we to a great extent govern ourselves. We make our own laws, run our own governments, and in the case of Menominee, provide our own courts, jails, and punishments, both civilly and criminally. So when we reach out to work with you on policy and legislation, we ask to be recognized as such as nations.
Here with us to talk more about today's speech is Richard Monette. He's a professor of law at UW-Madison and also the director of the Great Lakes Indian Law Center. Richard, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So first off, Richard, what was your biggest takeaway from today's speech?
Well, the biggest takeaway is for me was Mr. Bisaw's humor. My goodness, he's got a good sense of humor. You know, they say don't give up your day job, but I think he actually and get a job as a comedian. It was very funny from beginning to end, most of it very well-timed, and really enjoyed that part of it.
Yeah, he even made some jokes about making jokes at the beginning of his speech today, and then made some jokes about how good-looking the tribal leaders were. So got some laughs from lawmakers there. Now, this speech isn't just aimed at looking at concerns and issues facing the tribes in Wisconsin. It's also a chance for them to celebrate successes across the state. So on that note, where have we seen some of these successes in the past year when it comes to state government and tribal governments working together?
I think there's two ways of addressing that. First, I would say we haven't seen the kinds of successes or the extent of the success. What we have seen is success in restarting discussions and advancing some of them that have been going on for quite some time on a lot of issues, like sharing information back and forth between law enforcement and justice systems on the reservations and with their counterparts in the state. We've made some headway in the state regarding burial mounds and that sort of thing. So, you know, there are a lot of things that are working relatively well. We've seen in the courts sort of fits and starts, but where the courts are giving deference and maybe respecting the tribal courts a little more, recognizing that we have some overlapping jurisdiction and that it's okay to defer when truly their interests or their tribal citizens' interests are at stake. So I think you saw the tenor of that in Chairman Bisaw's talk today, mostly positive and looking forward, especially.
Now, as we did just hear in the intro coming into our conversation, Chairman Bisaw did talk about working together, and you kind of touched a little bit on that about deferring maybe to the tribes or to the state government. You know, can you just expand a little on some of those issues, particularly with maybe burial mounds, how contentious that has been between the two governments?
Well, sure. We have to start a conversation in Wisconsin and the tribes, it seems like, all the time. And I'm going to say increasingly, I'm going to say unfortunately, we have to. And that's over this federal law that's called Public Law 83-280. And in short, we hear it bandied about as PL-280 in the state. And all of the tribes are subject to it in the state except Menominee, which makes it complicated for Chairman Bisaw, because he's trying to talk about all the tribes, and he's giving a state of the tribes, not the state of Menominee. And on that, at least on that note in particular, his tribe is very much different from the other tribes and what they face in these issues. But nonetheless, to the extent that he was talking about them all, we've got this federal law that gives Wisconsin jurisdiction over crimes and over sort of lawsuits. in Indian country, you know, contract disputes, personal injury, medical malpractice, you know, lawsuits. And people in Wisconsin actually think that that's the normal lay of the land for the tribal nations, and it's not. There's only six states that are like that. Frankly, almost all of them are pulling back a little bit, except Wisconsin. And so what you have is the state with criminal jurisdiction. The feds continue to have some. The tribes insistently, increasingly want some and exercise some. And, you know, obviously their tribal norms are at stake. I mean, that's what's underlying criminal laws, right, and how we want people to behave. And it's the same thing in a certain respect with lawsuits as well. And so they are wanting to have that recognized increasingly, but we have this 1953 federal law that just apparently we can't find whatever it takes, the gumption, the courage, the smarts, the lack of smarts to undo this thing so we could address some of these insistent problems we have, persistent problems we have. And part of his talk, you could just hear that complexity in there, but he knows everybody in the room doesn't understand, including our state legislators. You could hear the irritation in his voice about it, and in particular, you can hear that, you know, he wants to shout loud and clearly, and the Menominee Nation is not subject to PL 280. And I think I'm not going to speak for Chairman Bisaw, but I think his opinion would be, and really that shouldn't be the case for any of the tribes anymore. Right, that's why he was saying that we are separate nations and live by our own laws. But you know, if somebody else is coming in and prosecuting crimes under their laws, you know, the district attorney in Wisconsin is not going into Lac de Flambeau and prosecuting Lac de Flambeau's laws. It's prosecuting Wisconsin's laws. So you say on the one hand, you know, we are our own nations, and then you got the state continuing to prosecute its own laws in the reservations. The state courts entertaining lawsuits from the reservation, sometimes between tribal members, sometimes between the tribal member and the tribe. And, you know, that it's just, it doesn't make sense anymore. And it seems like every time we have one of these calls, you know, I have to go through this too long of a short explanation. And it's really complicated. I wish we could just undo that. But anyway, that you heard that running throughout, and it just affects almost everything. And in some ways it impedes some of this progress and sort of some of the positive message that we heard. But I still think the positive message was genuine, and that there's a lot of positive things that are starting to re-happen in the state with the First Nations here. And I think it's getting better.
We're talking to Richard Monette right now. He is professor of law at UW-Madison, and he's also the director of the Great Lakes Indian Law Center. He's joining us to talk about the 14th annual State of the Tribes Address that was delivered today at the state capitol. Now, looking to some of the other concerns, we've been going over some of the ways that the state government and the tribal governments butt heads. Chairman Bisaw spoke of Governor Walker's push to implement drug testing for some Medicaid recipients and the impact it could have on the Native community. Take a listen to a bit of what he had to say.
We are concerned with the high rates of unemployment and low job opportunities on our rural reservations and the need to get our members ready for work. We fear that the lack of job opportunities and threat of drug testing will simply shift the cost of health care from the federal government to the tribes.
Richard, what is your response to what Chairman Bisaw had to say?
Well, I, you know, he's, for better or worse, sort of spot on with it. I mean, not all the tribes are flush with money, with gaming money. In fact, you could maybe argue that three or maybe four of them are doing okay. Still not really flush, except for maybe one, right? But that's not Menominee. I mean, his tribe is poor. They have a casino in, I think, Kashina, right? And I'm not sure if even people from Wisconsin know where that is. And so it just doesn't make money. And you know, when you have poverty of the kind that they have, it pervades the society. It in fact, the culture becomes a culture of poverty. and the lifeways affect the poverty and the way you need money and you don't have it, and so how you get it and how you deal with things. And, you know, he's pointing to the lack of employment, lack of jobs, lack of training, and it leads to drugs. It leads to other sort of health care issues. You know, not a new story. It's just that we have a tendency no longer, it seems, to believe that it's the same problems that we have in a poor part of Wisconsin, but exacerbated and maybe, you know, 5 or 10 times worse, and with some tribes like Menominee. And we seem to have forgotten that. I think it's sad, and I think, you know, he's certainly making a reminder of that. Now, he's getting into the weeds a bit, a bit complicated with how much the feds pay and how much the state pays, how much the tribe increasingly pays, and how Medicaid works or doesn't work for them. You know, they have the Indian Health Service, which actually in President Trump's budget actually got an increase of $400 million. So people are hearing, you know, that they're hearing the problem, and there's money for that. But now that's, you know, so because of Mr. Bisaw's speech, it's like, well, that might cut both ways. Is this an indication from the Trump administration that they understand that in fact some of these cuts are going to hurt the reservations more? There's going to be more health care problems. We'll put more money in health care and take care of that, but we're just not going to help with the poverty. And so it gets complicated. It gets into the thicket pretty quickly. But and far be it from me to say that the tribes have kind of liked the way it is. But.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us today. A lot to get to. Richard Monette is a professor of law at UW-Madison and also the director of the Great Lakes Indian Law Center. He joined us to talk about today's State of the Tribes address here at the Wisconsin State Capitol. First, researchers have long assumed that keeping humans away from eagle nests can help the birds live, grow, and reproduce. And new research from the University of Wisconsin-Madison appears to prove that theory.
The study combined 40 years of data from Voyageurs National Park, which is in far northern Minnesota, near the Canadian border.
Ben Zuckerberg is an associate professor of wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and is one of the study's authors. Central Time host Rob Ferret talked to him recently about the study.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, let's look at the big picture for bald eagles. What was the low point here in Wisconsin, and how have they recovered since then?
Yeah, so bald eagles have really undergone pretty dramatic population changes over the past two centuries. They were really rare in the mid-1900s, primarily due to human persecution and pesticides, notably DDT, and they were eventually listed for protection under the Endangered Species Act in 1978. So dating back to the early 1960s, there was less than 400 nesting pairs throughout the entire lower 48 United States, and to now they're nearly about 10,000 nesting pairs. So they've come up quite a bit, and in 2007, the bald eagle was officially delisted. So they have definitely recovered over the last 30 years or so, thanks to a number of different environmental protections and good efforts of the conservation agencies.
Yeah, it sounds like we did a bunch of stuff. A lot of different efforts were behind this. And what you're trying to tease out is what works, what actually made the difference. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. And one really important strategy that a number of agencies started implementing really around the 1960s was the use of what was referred to as these buffer zones around nest sites. And the idea behind these buffer zones is that agencies would set up areas that would generally restrict human activities. And the idea is to kind of keep human disturbance to a minimum so eagles can be kind of flustered by human activities like hunting, hiking, fishing, or boating. And in doing so, eagles can become agitated and potentially flush and even sort of lead to nest abandonment.
So this is if I'm out in nature and I'm not actually trying to interfere with the eagles at all. I'm doing whatever my thing happens to be, as you say, boating or hunting or whatever. I theoretically could be causing damage to those eagles without trying to.
Exactly. And that was always something that many sort of managers thought maybe a potential problem for eagles, especially in terms of their recovery and their nesting success. And so they decided to implement some of these strategies to try and minimize as much human disturbance around nest sites as possible. So eagles will tend to nest in sort of these big trees that are right near sort of open bodies of water like lakes and so forth, and they wanted to keep the disturbance around these nests to a real minimum.
And is this, do they post year-round, hey, don't come near this nest, or is it a seasonally important thing? How did that work on a practical level?
Yeah, it's a very seasonal thing. So during sort of the course or the, I'd say sort of the beginning of spring and into summer, they would set up these buffer zones once eagles have begun to establish these nests and start, you know, clearly feeding their young. And so they wanted to protect them from any kind of sort of activities that might interfere with some of those sort of breeding activities.
So hearing you describe it as a layperson, I hear, okay, we did these protections. It makes sense why they'd work. Eagle numbers are up. Great, it worked. But as scientists, as people who study the environment, you want a little more detail than that, right?
Exactly. And one of our sort of goals was to determine whether this really widely used management action that's not just applied for bald eagles, but other sort of raptor species as well, to setting up these buffer zones actually help the overall population. I think it makes sense that for an individual nest, that the more you do to kind of minimize any human disturbance surrounding that nest should do better. But over for the entire population, do we actually see that benefit play out? And so to do that, we teamed up with researchers at the National Park Service and the U.S. Geological Survey to answer this question in Voyageurs National Park, which is in northern Minnesota. It's a really beautiful national park. It's got a number of different activities from boating, camping, and hiking. But starting in sort of the early 1990s, the park staff began to set up buffer zones around a handful of eagle nests per year, and they started using warning signs to sort of deter boaters and campers from disturbing these nest sites. And the nice thing about this park and the staff that have been working there is that over the last 40 years, the staff have been conducting these annual aerial surveys of where bald eagles were nesting and whether the nests were in fact successful.
Talking to Ben Zuckerberg, Associate Professor of Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, talking about an effort to protect bald eagles and to figure out if that protection is working, in this case, buffer zones around eagle nests. So, Ben, it seems like it would be hard to tease this out, because if you know you're doing this, you're seeing eagle numbers going up, is that, well, it's still the residual effect of banning, say, DDT? Is it a habitat management nearby or elsewhere? Is it better food sources? How do you tease out whether this one thing, these buffer zones, are actually making the difference?
Yeah, and that's a great question, and that was really the challenge going into it. And it really would not be possible to answer that question without these surveys that were being conducted for the last 40 years in the park, going all the way back to the early 1980s, and you can actually be able to sort of track individual nests, both where eagles were nesting, but also how well they were doing. So how many nestlings did they have? Were those nestlings sort of successful in terms of surviving and eventually fledging from the nest? And so having that sort of really nice data set that goes back decades allowed us to kind of track whether or not this management, the setting up of these buffer zones, actually influenced the population overall. So what we were able to document was that by following that breeding population, the number of nesting pairs really hovered around 10 pairs or so, really dating back to late 1970s and really up until sort of the early 1990s, and that's when they really started to take off, and now the park hosts almost 50 pairs of bald eagles. And importantly, around the early 1990s is when they started setting up these buffer zones. And so what we were able to really capture and be able to measure was that eagles were more likely to, in fact, use a nest that was protected using these buffer zones the year before. And those eagles that actually were able to nest in these areas, in these buffer zones, resulted almost in an 8% increase in their nesting success and a 13% increase in the number of young that they were able to produce per nest. So this may seem like a fairly small benefit, but what we actually showed was that this practice increased the number of breeding pairs of bald eagles at Voyageurs by almost 40%.
Right, 8% or 10% or 13% a year over the course of a couple decades, that starts to add up, right?
Exactly, and that's exactly what we were able to show, that by having these buffer zones set up, that the overall population was able to recover much faster.
So good news there. Now, can we take this lesson and, as you said earlier, apply it to other raptors who might be in a dire circumstances elsewhere?
Absolutely. And I think that is really one of the strongest applications of this kind of approach, is that even though what you could think of as being a very sort of individual level management, where you're kind of going to individual nests and even just having a few of these nests within a population, that the benefits pay out over a long time. And that benefit to the population can actually occur for species that are beginning to recover and maybe even hasten that recovery.
Do you have usual suspects in mind, other raptors that you think, hey, this could be a benefit for these specific guys?
I definitely think other species like ospreys that is another bird that has really suffered sort of the post-DDT effects. They have shown a very similar trajectory in terms of their recovery over time. And in fact, a number of sort of management agencies think about buffer zones as well for ospreys.
When I think of the realm of environmental interventions, there are some really expensive fixes out there. This is putting up signs. This seems like a pretty cheap way, if it's working, to do this kind of thing.
Absolutely. And to me, this is a nice story in the sense that all of conservation is not all doom and gloom. This recovery represents one of the continent's most successful conservation stories. And I think it also is an important tale in the sense that when given support, both in terms of funds and environmental laws and protection, our conservation agencies can be very successful in what they do. And something as simple as setting up buffer zones can be a very effective means of conservation.
We'll leave it there for now. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
That was Central Time host Rob Ferret talking to Ben Zuckerberg. He's an associate professor of wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and one of the authors of a study that found protecting eagle nests from humans can help the birds prosper.
Now, the combined North and South Korean Olympic team was greeted with a standing ovation and enthusiastic applause at the opening ceremonies of the Pyeongchang Winter Olympic Games. But in the VIP booth, the atmosphere was considerably more chilly, with U.S. Vice President Mike Pence choosing to remain seated.
Pence and North Korean envoy Kim Yo-jong, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, both chose to ignore each other, and no interactions were observed.
But outside of that setting, Kim Yo-jong was treated warmly, and her presence was welcomed, especially when she delivered overtures like an invitation for South Korean President Moon Jae-in to visit Pyongyang for talks.
Despite his approach to the games, Pence indicated shortly after that Washington might be open to communication with Pyongyang after all.
Uk He is a university distinguished professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He specializes in international relations, comparative politics, and Asian politics, particularly those of the Korean Peninsula. Uk, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, pleasure is mine.
Do we know who made the first move for North Korea to send athletes to compete in Pyeongchang?
I'm not exactly sure whether I believe that South Korea made the first move, but publicly it wasn't released. South Korea was interested in taking the initiative because it could symbolize to ease tensions in the region. So that's the reason I believe the Seoul government made the first move.
And those arrangements happened not very long before the opening ceremonies, the beginning of the games. There had to be some special arrangements made to allow those athletes to compete. Do we know if the U.S. was in favor of making those exceptions and making that happen?
Eventually, the U.S. government had to agree because in order to have North Korean athletes in South Korea, they had to break some UN sanctions. So Washington eventually agreed, but I don't think Washington was very enthusiastic about it.
And for someone like you who studies Korean politics and is also Korean, what was it like to watch that combined Korean team enter the stadium?
Well, I guess, yeah, different Koreans can have different feelings. I personally did not like that because having a unified team is just a political show. It doesn't really have any practical meaning. Moreover, politicians wanted to put up a show like that at the price of individual athletes. in order to make room for North Korean athletes, some South Korean hockey players, after working for years to be on the national team, they had to give up their seats. Mm. So I don't think it was fair to those athletes.
So the position of different South Korean governments has changed or shifted over the years regarding relations with North Korea. How would you characterize the position of South Korean President Moon Jae-in's administration on relations with the North?
See, in Korea, since Korea democratized in 1987, there have been shifts between conservatives and progressives. When conservative governments, they favored a hardline approach of putting pressure on North Korea for nuclear dismantling. However, a progressive government always employed engagement, and they preferred engagement policies, and they looked at North Korea from compatriotic perspective rather than prime enemy with a nuclear threat. Because of that, Washington and Seoul had disagreements and sometimes frictions when there is a conservative administration in Washington while there's a progressive government in Seoul, which is the case today.
So
the current government is a progressive and more sympathetic to the North and prefer engagement and dialogue.
And, Ook, as you said earlier in relation to, you know, how you viewed and how different Koreans might view that unified team coming in, there are also, like in any country, there are different threads of belief and conviction in South Korean society. Are there parts of South Korean society that ally more with, say, what the Trump administration's approach is rather than their own government's approach?
Absolutely. See, whenever this North Korea policy is debated, conservatives have favored putting more pressure and lacking or not providing aid to North Korea. And they sided with Washington's approach of putting more pressure on North Korea. So there's a conservative side. At the same time, there are progressives who see North Koreans as fellow Koreans from compatriotic perspective, and they feel that North Korea is doing poorly and we need to help them. And so they try to see things from North Koreans' perspective. Having said that, when you look at things from North Korean perspective, there are two different perspectives. They're citizens and authoritarian leaders. So which one are you looking at that can lead to a different preference?
Ook Hoo is a university distinguished professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. We're talking about current relationships between North Korea, South Korea, and Washington. And Ook, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un sent his sister, Kim Yo-jung, as his representative to the Games. What do we know about her?
Oh, not much. It has nothing much has been known about her. But see, there was an anecdote when Kim Jong-nam officially number one ranked representing North Korea, but when they visited the Korean president's mansion, Blue House, see, Kim Jong-nam was going to sit in the main chair facing Korean President Moon Jae-in. But when Kim Yo-jong came in, Kim Jong-nam yielded the seat. Mm. And Kim Yo-jong actually did not take the seat. It symbolized the power of Kim Yo-jong. So besides Kim Jong-un, Kim Yo-jong, who is a sister of Kim Jong-un, is the second highly ranked person in North Korea.
And has she taken this role as representative of her brother, the North Korean leader, in other settings, say, with allies of North Korea, like perhaps China?
No, it hasn't happened yet. So this is the first time. She has not represented North Korea diplomatically in dealing with other countries yet.
And how would you say that she was received overall?
She was well received by the Korean government she brought a letter of Kim Jong-un and invited South Korean President Moon Jae-in to North Korea. So she was actually quite tactful, and she was well received. So I believe she achieved her objective of coming down to South Korea.
As you just mentioned, she delivered a letter from her brother Kim Jong-un to South Korean President Moon Jae-in, inviting him to Pyongyang for talks. How significant is that? That seems like a pretty big step.
It is. In my opinion, Kim Jong-un is, even though he's bluffing of attacking the United States with nuclear weapons or whatever all kinds of rhetorics, but in some ways he is also scared about the potential attack by U.S. forces. So I believe that he wants to get out of this brinkmanship and potential U.S. strike on North Korea, and he wants to create a disguised peaceful mood. And that's what he is trying to do. And I believe he was quite successful. And there was some room between Seoul and Washington in terms of talking to North Korea and having a potential summit meeting. See, there was a report yesterday in one of the Korean main newspapers that the reason Michael Pence, U.S. Vice President, changed his position from being hostile and did not wanting to talk to Kim Yo-jong or any North Korean official, but on the return flight, he opened the possibility of dialogue with North Korea. According to a media released yesterday, one of the Korean media's words, see, Michael Pence asked Moon Jae-in, why would you want to talk to North Korea? And South Korean President Moon Jae-in responded that he will talk, and the talk would be only meaningful if North Korea is willing to take a step towards nuclear dismantling. In other words, Michael Pence and President Moon were on the same page that talks does not mean anything. They will make a positive move only if North Korea take a step towards nuclear disarmament.
We're talking with Uk He about the current state of U.S.-North Korean relations. He's a university distinguished professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Trump administration's hard line on North Korea? Do you think that the overtures by North Korea are genuine and a sign of more openness? Or do you think it's a calculated to drive a wedge between Washington and Seoul? How afraid are you of an escalation of tensions between the U.S. and North Korea? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson. We're continuing our look at the state of U.S.-North Korean relations after the North sent athletes and envoys to the Winter Games in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Our guest is Uk He of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think that the North is acting in good faith, or is this just a calculated PR move? And does it matter? How should Seoul and Washington respond? Call 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. And we talked about the fact that Kim Yo-jong and Vice President Pence were in the VIP booth together, and that they basically decided to ignore each other and not acknowledge each other. Do you think that either one or the other might have made a different choice in that situation?
Oh, I don't think so. See, so far, both of them are trying to have power over the other, and there's no mood for dialogue or conversation. So even if in other situations, encounters like this, they would be acting in a very similar way. So I don't think there was any surprise with that.
Let's go to the phones, and Patrick in Milwaukee is up first. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, this is another opportunity for our country to show how great and brave we are. and, you know, not continue down the road of sable rattling. It's only more threatening to the people directly around that, the South Koreans, the Japanese. So I wish Trump would not try to play the good cop, bad cop guy and try a sincere diplomacy towards peace.
Thanks so much for that call, Patrick. And Ook, I wanted to ask you, and it folds into what Patrick just said. You know, in October, President Trump tweeted, "I told Rex Tillerson, our wonderful Secretary of State, that he is wasting his time trying to negotiate with Little Rocket Man. Save your energy, Rex. We'll do what has to be done." Then yesterday, Tillerson was asked about talks with North Korea when he was in Egypt, and he said, as we've said for some time, it's really up to the North Koreans to decide when they're ready to engage with us in a sincere way, a meaningful way. They know what has to be on the table for conversation. So, look, with Trump and Pence and Tillerson all in the fray and some tendencies towards saber rattling, as Patrick said, who do you think at this point is really setting the course for where this relationship might go?
Oh, I don't think that anyone is dominating. It's a game between three, four different players. And see, in order to, because their goals are different, in order to talk about what path we should take or what we want to achieve through this kind of political behavior is, it has to start from analyzing what North Korea wants with nuclear weapons and why they want to have the bomb. See, unless we analyze and discuss that, all these kinds are just in the middle of routes that they are trying to achieve certain political goals, and Washington wants to have other political goals, and they can confront each other. And so, and I don't think I can talk about this because it takes a while to understand why they want and what Washington wants and why these two countries are facing this level of tension and what's at stake and what South Korea wants in this situation. It's a complex equation that mm-hmm. we are dealing with.
And in just a little less than a minute that we have, Ook, what do you think the North's next move might be?
They will continue to do so, that they will bluff in one way and use a harsh rhetoric. And but at the same time, after the Pyeongchang Olympic Games, in my personal opinion, they are not going to push any further. They will see how South Korea reacts to North Korea, and they will try to have a peaceful move so that they will try to have friction or a disagreement between Washington and Seoul. That's the goal of sending Kim Yo-jong and the envoys to Pyeongchang. They want to have a room between Seoul and Washington so that they can get in there and try to create disagreements.
Well, certainly a lot for us to follow up on there. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ook.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Ook He is a university distinguished professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He specializes in international relations, comparative politics, and Asian politics, particularly those of the Korean Peninsula. And he joined us to discuss the current state of U.S. relations with both North and South Korea.
When Brian Hansen steps out onto the ice in Pyeongchang this week, he knows exactly how his skates should sound.
Click, 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 click.
That's when he's on a straightaway, and when he hits his first turn,
click, 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 click.
He's one of the three speed skaters representing Team USA in this year's Winter Olympics, who call Pettit National Ice Center in Milwaukee home ice. Rachel Vasquez introduces us to the team as part of our special coverage of Wisconsin athletes in this year's Winter Games.
Hansen is an Illinois native who spent a lot of time training at Pettit, and that's his impression of a clap skate. It's a special kind of ice skate that speed skaters use. That's 24 skaters, their clap skates, and a sellout crowd at Pettit last month on the final day of Olympic trials. Mitch Whitmore was there that night, too. He's a long track speed skater who moved to Waukesha when he was 15. And when you ask him how long he's been training for, he's got this for an answer.
I have been training for 19 years.
He's been skating since he was 9 years old. And he says in its most basic form, speed skating is two skaters, one in each lane, and then...
essentially just go as fast as you can.
There are a lot of different kinds of races, but yeah, that's pretty much it. Sometimes a skater is trying to get the best time across multiple heats, or sometimes they're racing against fellow skaters. One of the races Whitmore will be competing in is the 500 meter, a race that happens to be one of his favorites.
Because it's over the quickest.
Brian Hansen started his speed skating career when he was 8 years old.
I remember being excited, except it was a very new thing at the time, and I was really little. But, you know, I do remember, you know, it was something new and unique and exciting. And that was cool. And I was happy to be a part of that.
He may skate as many as three races, one of which is called the Team Pursuit.
The Team Pursuit is a team race. So there's three people working together. And basically you alternate leads so that all three of you can get across the line the fastest.
That's the main difference with the Team Pursuit. The group works together to win.
It's all about drafting and pushing off each other, and that's what makes it a teamwork and team race.
We won't know the group of skaters racing the Team Pursuit until the day of the race. But one other athlete favored for the team is Emery Lehman. He's a junior at Marquette University in Milwaukee. He studies civil engineering there, and at Olympic trials last month, he was pretty excited to make the team.
Especially that's at the Pettit. It means a lot to have such a big competition at your home ice.
He also kicked off the week's competition in the 5,000-meter race, a grueling 12.5 laps around the Olympic Oval. Those laps were finally starting to catch up with him after he qualified for the team.
Trying to fall asleep last night, my legs were throbbing, so a little tired this morning.
He wasn't even sure if he'd make the team. So when he did, he had to make a few arrangements.
Yeah, I gotta email my advisor and withdraw from classes. Other than that, yeah, just prepping.
All three of them have different strengths in speed skating, and at least two of them do a pretty good rendition of the Olympic anthem.
Something like that.
Wisconsin's 2018 Team USA speed skaters, Mitch Whitmore and Brian Hansen. Rachel Vasquez, Wisconsin Public Radio.
To learn more about all of Wisconsin's Olympic athletes and to see how they're doing, go to our website, wpr.org/Olympics.